Okay, so welcome back, everyone, to the podcast, Farmers and Friends of the Kickapoo. And I'm Robert Bauer. I'm a grazing specialist and resource conservationist for Golden Sands Resource Conservation and Development Council, which is based in Stevens Point, Wisconsin. And Golden Sands RC&D is a 501c3 nonprofit, and we work across county lines in 12 counties in central Wisconsin, cooperatively to address natural resource conservation issues and promote economic development. And today I am on the Grant River, which is in Grant County, Wisconsin, and I'm with Steve Kenyon, who is an internationally recognized expert and advocate for well-managed grazing. So I want to let Steve introduce himself a little bit more, and then I'll kind of talk about what we're looking at today on the podcast.
Excellent. Thank you. Steve Kenyon. I'm from near Edmonton, Alberta, up in Canada, and we're down here for a series of pasture walks this week, and quite a excellent opportunity to get to come kayak on the Grant River here. Kind of a nice difference from some of my other trips.
Yeah, what was your trip into the States like?
The flights to get here weren't, they weren't easy and convenient. We ended up getting a long layover and then got in pretty late last night. So, but that's typical because normally I go to rural areas. So you hit one big airport and then have to go to a little airport somewhere. So that's expected.
Yeah. So you drove from, was it Madison?
Yeah. Yeah.
Out here, you said you stopped in Platteville.
Yeah, actually, the GPS took us kind of cross-country to get here, and we saw some very interesting and neat parts of the countryside.
Yeah, so we're here down here in near Potosi, which is basically on the Mississippi River, give or take, or near Cassville, floating on the Grant. And what are some of the things that you noticed as you're going across the landscape there from Madison?
First thing I noticed was corn, soybeans. it was a few cows, lots of old dairy, old silos. I don't know if looked like a bunch of them were no longer active. But yeah, definitely very heavy in corn and soybeans.
Yeah, is that what you were expecting? Have you been in this area?
I've been to Wisconsin before. Most of my trips I get to come in the wintertime, so I don't get to see the plant life and the crops and stuff. So I wasn't sure what I was expecting coming to this part. I haven't been to this part of the state before.
Yeah, have you heard the term driftless before?
No, I have not.
Okay. Yeah, this is, I think it's potentially part of the driftless. Yeah, so, you know, maybe you're familiar with the driftless just being an area that hasn't been glaciated for the last 2 million years.
Okay, yeah.
And so the, you know, the soils are a little older, the landscape's more deeply eroded, or, you know, it's kind of a lot more topography here.
It looks like you're a lot closer to bedrock than we are where I'm from.
Yeah, tell me more about, like, what it's like where you're at.
So the Edmonton area, I'm actually originally from Saskatchewan, but I moved to Alberta in 1999, so that's where I've spent most of my farming career. It's the Westlock area has a lot of black soil zone, so it's mostly grain as well. Whereas we're always, you know, pretty much always wheat and canola, typical. We do some barley, oats. There's a fair bit of oats, actually, I guess. Some peas. We're right on the edge of the black soil zone. So then we get into the gray wooded soil zone where most of my land is. And then it's mostly cattle country.
Yeah, so what do you mean by, like, black soil zone? Those are prairie soils? Or? Yeah,
prairie soils. Grown under grasslands, you know, 3,000 years ago. Whereas the gray wooded soil zone where I am, most of my land was grown under leaf litter, so it was a forest. Basically, black soil zone is the high quality land that all the grain farmers want, and the gray wooded, they don't really want. However, I've changed that. And now I have black soil where my pastures are. I actually have grain farmers that chase me around and try and buy up my land. So, because I rent all my land, it's a little different scenario. We are 45 minutes outside of the fifth largest city in Canada. So agriculture can't really pay for the land. So I lease all my land that's there. I've been doing that since about 2001. I started leasing land.
What got you started with that?
I didn't have any land. Like, we only had one little piece of land up there. And if I wanted to expand, the only way I could, because, you know, to cash flow buying, you know, 17 quarters of land is not feasible. So we just started renting it. And the cash flow was way better. So then we just kept renting and renting more and more. So,
what was your first property like, you said, that you rented?
The first property? Well, I bought one. And then I rented one next to it. And then I ended up buying it through an investor. I technically bought it first, and then I turned it over to some investors right away. And I've had that land ever since. So that's kind of nice. It's still the cash flow of renting, but I still have control of the land. That's been 25 years, I think, I've had that.
What was that process like? Was it cropland then when you bought it, or pasture?
Perennial. It could have been, right? Somebody had worked it up at one point, some of it. There was one part of it that was forested 2 years ago that they bulldozed and cleared, and you could still see the burn piles. And when I took it over right away, it went back into perennial forage, and it's been pasture ever since. So.
How did you set that system up? What was that process like for setting it up for grazing and perennial?
Basically, it was a cultivated field, and I broadcast and trampled. So I'll broadcast seed. I still do it, you know, on fields I take over nowadays.
Heard you talk about that on your show.
Yeah, just put the seed out there and let the cows harrow it in, basically. Turn them out there, and they go around and they eat all the volunteers and all the weeds that are coming up. If you get a little bit of rain, that definitely helps. I've had some amazing catches that way.
What were the fences, water? Like, what's the water source in that area?
We don't have much water. Is it the odd little creek, maybe a spring runoff creek? We rely a lot on snowmelt for water. Dugouts, which you guys would call ponds. Canadians call them dugouts. And then we pump from those to a water trough. You know, if we get a good winter, we got, you know, a foot to 2-3 feet of snow that melts. It'll melt in the springtime, which would be, sometime late March, early April, probably. That will flow because it melts so quick, and it'll fill up any little potholes or dugouts or ponds that we have. But if we have a winter without a lot of snow, we could be in trouble because all of a sudden our dugouts are really low at this. Like, that's what happened this year. Some of my dugouts, I've never seen them lower than this spring. And normally in the fall is when they're low. After you've used them and, you know, all summer there's been evaporation or whatever. But, water is one of my biggest concerns. And, you know, being able to get water to the cattle water to the cattle, yeah. So.
Sure. Yeah, I want to ask you a lot more about that. I want to kind of bring back to the topic of what we're looking at today, though. I know you were coming in. We both looked at some things as we were launching the kayaks. And I showed you the river stage, right? So I said, according to the rain gauge, it rained almost an inch last night. And then the river rose. Did you see that? It was like 15 feet.
Yeah.
It went from like 5 feet to, was it 20 plus feet?
Yeah. Do you know what that tells me right there? It's a broken water cycle here somewhere.
Well, yeah, I could see that.
Like, how on earth does that raise the river that much? It's only an inch. Right, I've seen 4 inches at home, and my pastures absorb it all. Yeah. Now, a few years back, we were really, really dry. I remember my dugouts were empty, right? I was starting to get worried about having to ship cattle home early. We had 4 inches in 36 hours, right? It just dumped, and everybody was cheering. I mean, the ditches along the highways were running like rivers, right? The water was just gushing down them. There was people kayaking, speaking of kayaking, and canoeing in the parking lots of the grocery store in town, right? There was videos online about it. And so everybody's all excited that, yeah, the drought's over, yay. I went out to some of my dugouts. They'd only raised up a foot.
And your land soaked it up?
The land soaked it up. 2 weeks later, my dugouts were overflowing.
I went look at, I mean, just here, like, along these banks, You know, when we were trying to actually get in, there was all that mud at the landing, right? It was like, and we can see some of that here, just like all the sediment that's trapped by the vegetation.
Well, they might not. I'm trying to go sideways here a little bit for them to see, maybe.
Yeah, and you can. But I mean, it's like you can see the line.
The water last night. The water was what, 6 feet higher?
Yeah, probably at least.
Like where it was washing on the banks here. So yeah, it went up pretty high here. And yeah, that's just too much water running off the land and not enough being held by the land.
Yeah, so I'm just really fascinated with that. And yeah, you know, I went to kind of mention something. You know, we're calling this podcast Farmers and Friends of the Kickapoo, but you know, I think we're kind of having an identity crisis here with this episode, you know, because we're on the Grant River. But, you know, this is part of an area for the project that I'm working on, you know, where I'm working with people on the land to write grazing plans. And we got funding from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation to do outreach and connect with people. And that's how we ended up working with you. And I just wanted to touch on that real quick before I forget, you know, which is that, you know, in partnership with several other groups in Wisconsin, like you said, Sauk County Land and Environment Department kind of started that conversation with you. And then we pulled in Vernon County and Valley Stewardship Network. And then thanks to Grassworks, I think they deserve like so much credit for this. Just, you know, with their support, being able to bring you, you know, for these 5 days down here. And, you know, Grassworks, you know, you've spoken at the Grassworks conference before, right? So you're familiar with it, but for folks who don't know, you know, it's a membership-based nonprofit organization that is a resource for grazers, you know, in the state of Wisconsin and beyond. And they have an annual conference, like you said, where you spoke several years ago, and then in 2026, they're actually going to be in La Crosse, which is really close, you know, to the area where I'm working here. And it's January, they just announced it, January 22nd to 26th in La Crosse. And they have a call for presentations and things out now. So I'm just looking forward to that. But.
So another observation, that cornfield's awfully close to this river. It's right beside it, right up to the bank. So there's no filter zone, there's no buffer zone, right? I like to leave enough space, especially if livestock are going to be using a water source too. But I mean, just the runoff coming off that is, there's no, you know, nothing's going to catch it. There's not even hardly any shrubs here on the riverbank up to the corn. The other side looks okay. It's got lots of trees and vegetation and all sorts of wildflowers.
Yeah, what was that you said to me earlier about the water? Something you were going to point out.
The water is very dirty. Not unexpected. I mean, we have very dirty rivers too, but it just seems that's what happens in agricultural areas, right? There's just a broken water cycle. We've got soil erosion right there. There's a bank that's fallen down, right? That's soil erosion right there. We need stable banks and stable land to hold on to the water and hold on to the soil. Yeah, we've got rivers. We've got some land up by just family land. It's up by a lake in north central Saskatchewan, and the rivers are crystal clear. It's just that there's no agricultural there. Just cattle and, you know, haylands, but those are all perennials most of the time. So yeah, rivers are crystal clear. It's gorgeous up there.
Yeah, in the areas near you where there are water quality problems, what are people doing to work on that?
I don't know what other people are doing. I mean, we got lots of watersheds working on stuff, but for me, it's creating a natural way to filter. Okay, so here's an example. I have one pasture that I actually got years ago, and I should have done this long, long ago, but there was already a water system set up. There was a dugout that had pumped up to a tank, and then it gravity flowed to a trough. So I just left it. I mean, it was already there. It was already working, so I left it there. But the problem with it was on the trough was on the high side of the dugout. So basically all the cattle would come drink out of that trough. The manure and urine would get left there. And then in a heavy rain or in the springtime when the snow melted off, it would flow basically right into the dugout from that, you know, through that spot, taking all that manure and urine into the water system. So I got away with it for years, not changing it, because we had lots of moisture and lots of water, and it, like that dugout would fill up. But then a few years we were pretty dry and the dugout got really low. And then all of a sudden I started getting all sorts of yucky, smelly algae and growth, and the quality of water just dropped drastically. So what we did is we changed where the water trough was. We pulled it away, farther away, so that any of that flow would go in another direction. And we also basically fenced off that entire area so that the cattle couldn't get to it. And now it's overgrown with grass and forages, and it's basically a filter strip now. So the water still flows into the dugout that way, but, you know, there's probably years and years and years of manure that's there, but we've got a lot cleaner water. And like I said, this year the dugout is lower than I've ever seen it, and the water still looks like it's in good quality. So protecting those water sources, fencing them off, not letting animals into it. Now, not ever, because once in a while, end of a season to clean it up or something, I might take my donkeys down there. Or a few years I've had bulls that we needed to pull and just need them for a quick spot to keep them. I could kick them in there just as a, you know, place to store them for a little while. And it knocks down the vegetation. You know, once every few years, that's not a bad thing, knock down that vegetation. All that manure and urine getting washed into that water source was definitely causing some water health issues.
You're commenting on the stream banks here with the corn, so I'm seeing that again on this stretch. This is real straight stretch, not even a corner, and the crops right up to the river.
Yeah, like they need a buffer zone here. You could, you know,
I would imagine maybe it's actually moved, you know, even during the time the crop has been here.
Yeah, it's been washed away. Well, we need more stable root systems to hold that bank because it's just falling away. Some trees, shrubs, get something in there that's going to hold that bank solid.
Mm-hmm. A little farther back, there was some pasture. I think we're going to come up on some more pasture here along the river. Do you have some streamside pastures?
Yes, but we fence them off.
Okay, you'll completely just keep them out? Or how does that work?
Same thing, not completely. In a drought, we might graze them, right? That's an extra paddock.
So you create some access points. Is that what you're saying?
No, we pump from the water. Yeah, we always pump from the water. Very few of my locations that animals have access to it. I mean, if it's a creek, we'll fence it off, but we might still graze it. But we'll still give them a trough that we pump to.
Like a nose pump then? Or you said you use up diesel, or how do you...
A lot of solar. We use a few gas-powered pumps, maybe a generator and a pump. Just depends on the situation, what's easier. If possible, gravity flow. I love gravity flow, but you got to have water up on a hill for that. Or part way up a hill, anyway.
Yeah. I heard you talking to Troy Bishop about this.
Yeah.
And I guess it was a year or more ago. But you were talking about how you liked, was it a certain kind of diesel generator? Because you could use it for other things?
Oh, just a generator. It doesn't really matter what type. If you buy a gas-powered water pump, it's really an engine with a water pump mounted to it. If one of them breaks, well, the other one's probably still good, but the whole thing is useless to you. But if I buy a generator and then buy a separate pump, right, well, if one of them breaks, I just replace it. And I still got the other one working. And then the generator's handy, too, because then if I say I got to do some construction or something, or, you know, build a fence or whatever, I've got power out there to run power tools or something if I need, so. Or in the wintertime, a heat tape or a battery charger or something for my solar.
What kind of size solar panels do you need for this kind of system?
Depends on the herd, depends on the lift, right? It's all basically a math equation. Depends on your system.
What kind of herds are you watering? Like, what size of herds or number of animals?
Largest herd I've ever had is 900 head of steers. They were probably 700 to 800 pounds. Right now, my biggest herd is 300 bred heifers. We run about 1,000 head total, but we got multiple locations. So.
So you would water the whole group potentially with tanks out of a river? I'm sure it's different things, different places.
With one system. So if it was a solar system, let's say I had this land here beside the river, I'd have a fence running along, giving me the buffer zone, or create this whole paddock that could be grazed on this side. But then I would pump past that buffer zone and put a trough. And that way, you're really limited. Remember I described that dugout where, you know, the cow manure gets washed into it, right? That it's really hard to avoid that on a river because everything flows down to the river. You don't really have a choice. So you create that buffer zone to get farther away from the river where the manure is. And then, you know, any of that runoff, you've got plants and root systems to kind of clean that water before it gets to the river.
Yeah, do you have a rule of thumb, so to speak, about how far to keep the animals from the water?
Depends on the size of the pasture and the size of the herd. The bigger it is, the farther away you want it. And every piece of land's different, right? You got to kind of put it in a useful spot, too, for the cell design. So kind of hard to say. I would just look at it and make a decision, I guess.
Yeah, and you're talking about cell designs, which maybe that's a kind of a different terminology than we use, but, you know, tell me more about that, what that means.
So cell design would be how you lay out your paddocks or your fencing to create a rotational grazing system of some kind. So that's going to depend on where your water goes too, because, you know, how does that work to make it useful?
So in a setting like this, what might you do?
Yeah, I might pump farther to it, you know, depending on the pasture. I mean, every piece is different, but I might pump farther up to a storage tank or something, and then it could gravity flow in multiple directions to multiple troughs. If you can get water to the hill somehow, then you've got more options for water.
Yeah, what kind of size of pumps are you working with then to do something like that?
2-inch gas water pump, I guess. Not that bad. We don't have that much elevation. We're not in the mountains or anything, so it doesn't take too much in our environment. If I can easily pump up 50 feet with those. And that's elevation, not distance, right? It's the height that is the more the issue with pumping water than the distance.
Yeah, and you'd pump it into what, like a polyethylene storage tank?
Yeah, whatever I can find cheap. Lots of times I just look on the local buy and sell and find stuff that's cheap. I've got some steel tanks, I've got some plastic tanks.
Yeah, and then you gravity flow it from that?
Yeah. Now the distance for the water lines, that's, you need the diameter of pipe for that. The smaller the pipe, the more restriction you have. Resistance, I guess you'd call it. And so you need a large diameter pipe. So most of mine is at least 1.5 inches when I'm trying to do a bit of a pipeline.
And it's all surface pipeline usually what you're doing? Or
I don't bury it because I've got all rented land. So if I ever lose a piece of land, I can take my pipeline with me.
Very nice. So what do you do in the winter to graze? Like, I know part of your talks, your resume is about winter grazing, you know. So how does that work?
Similar. We've got some solar systems that we can do out of what we call them as a wet well. So there'll be a culvert dug in that's vertical beside a water source. And there's a pipe that connects the water source and the culvert together. So basically underground, the water can move into this vertical culvert. And then the top of the vertical culvert, we've got a kind of a water bowl. Picture your bathroom sink with the little holes around it. And there's a hole in the middle that we can pump up. We put a motion sensor on it or a timer, depending on the situation. And then the cattle can just drink out of there. And when they're done drinking, it just goes right back down underground. So it doesn't freeze up.
So it kind of keeps the water moving. Is that right? That's part of it?
Or just when the cattle are there. Like if it's a motion sensor, it'll just turn on when they show up. So you only had 1 inch of rain.
That's what the gauge said.
That shocked me.
Yep. The USGS.
Yeah, like 1 inch of rain, you should see nothing. Like that should just be... I'm gonna ask you some questions.
Go ahead.
What's your average rainfall in this environment?
Like annual?
Yeah. Growing season?
You know, I'm not well researched, but I think it's like 42 to 46 inches. I'll have to eat my words if I'm wrong.
Yeah, that's quite a difference. So you're in quite a wet environment compared to me. Our average rainfall for our growing season, so we don't include snowfall, because that varies quite a bit. And then it just runs off in the springtime. Usually the ground is frozen, so you don't actually get that moisture. Our average growing season moisture is about 15 inches.
Right, that's like arid.
Well, this year I've got one pasture that up until last week it had only had 2 inches. So we're quite dry compared to you. Now, there's drier areas than we are, that's for sure. But on average, I would say across North America, we're definitely on the drier side.
So what do you do to manage in that environment? Are you giving it longer rest periods or?
Building the soil armor. One of the biggest priorities, like the most important nutrient I have is definitely water. So every year I plan for a drought. Every year I'm leaving residue. Every year I'm, you know, trying to improve the water holding capacity of my soil.
Yeah, this is definitely something we're noticing. Like on the last episode, we were talking about, you know, kind of the extremes, you know, of drought and flood. And that seems to be more common, either, you know, really, really heavy rainfall events or some drought events in this area, for sure. Yeah, I want to learn more about this environment you're grazing in. So 15 inches of rain a year is what you said, right?
Yeah.
So like a rest period for a pasture.
I actually just wrote an article on that. It'll be coming out in Stock and Grass Farmer soon. Rest period varies all the time, everywhere, all the time. Basically, my answer is it depends on a lot of things, right? So our environment, basically, if I was just starting with a piece of land, I didn't know too much about it, my first one would probably be a twice over rotation, which would mean my first rest period, we'd get two grazings out of it, basically, is the twice over rotation. First rest period would be 40 to 50 days. And then depends on how the season goes, right? Our second one just depends on the growth because our growing season, I guess the biggest difference we probably have is we have a 4.5 month growing season. That's it. So whatever we grow in 4.5 months, that's, you know, how long can we graze? Well, I have grazed 8 or 9 months or 10 months just on pasture, but that depends on management. So if we have that 40 to 50 day rest period on the first one, then our second one's probably going to be, you know, 90 days plus, but we're never getting to the third one. Or once in a while, if I've got a really good pasture, maybe I've been managing it for a while, we'll get part of a third rotation. So technically it would be 2.5 rotations. So some of the paddocks would get grazed twice, and some, you know, some of the better ones might get grazed a third time at the, you know, in the dormant season.
And like, what kind of yield do you get from your pasture in terms of tons of dry matter?
I don't measure in tons of dry matter. I measure in animal days, but we can be up to 200 animal days per acre.
Can you convert that for the audience?
Yeah. It's kind of hard because some people measure in stock days per acre, some in animal days per acre, but they have a different rate from it. I originally took mine from a mentor of mine, Dennis Wabasser. He started out with, or he was a holistic management practitioner. So that's where I first got mine from. And his was actually even a little different than most of holistic management. So I can convert it to the universal language for farmers. We can make anywhere from $60 an acre to $350 an acre, depending on the land.
Well, okay, so in Wisconsin, a typical stocking rate is 1,000 pounds of animal live weight per acre per year during the growing season. And the growing season is usually about 6 months. So 180 days. So would that be and I guess it depends on what kind of animal. You know, 1,000 pounds is probably smaller than a typical cow, right? Maybe a typical cow might be 1,200 or 1,300 pounds.
Yeah.
So that would mean maybe it's 7/10 of an animal per acre? I'm just, you know, or three quarters?
Yeah, my base unit is a 700-pound yearling. So instead of the 1,000 pounds. So little different. It's hard to compare apples to oranges. All three sessions that we're doing this week, we're going to go into economics of grazing. And I've got my pasture calculator that anybody even listening to the podcast, if you email me, I'll gladly send it to you. Because every pasture is different. You got to run your numbers and see if it's worth doing what you're doing.
So you're grazing anywhere from 4 months to 8 months out of the year. What species are you grazing?
We are definitely mostly cool season. You know, if I'm first putting in a pasture, taking over some grain land or something, I will put in some warm seasons, but we're definitely a cool season environment, so C3 plants. So we got bromes, orchard grass, I like some fescues, I like some creeping grasses and some bunch grasses. Legumes, mostly what I'm doing right now is adding legumes to pastures. I actually bought a drone, I don't know if you knew that. I bought a big seeding drone just to top dress pastures because I got tired of top dressing with the ground equipment because it's hard on equipment and hard on my back. The drone's pretty handy. So in my environment, clovers do really well, but as soon as you get a drought year, the clovers all die out and then you're kind of starting again. So after every severe drought, now I've learned I just add some more seed. We get a good wet spell and it'll kick back in and we're rocking again.
What time of the year, what time of the year do you seed the legumes or do you broadcast the seed?
There's a couple different ways of doing that. If you've got an established pasture, I mean, you're not going to get a great germination just throwing seeds out there. So a couple of tricks I do. One is frost seeding. So in the springtime when the snow's gone, but we still have the ground's freezing at night but thawing during the day. Then I can get the seed out there. And then that freeze-thaw action helps us out there. You caught on a deadwood there. That really have some really good results sometimes. Small window, though, right? That can maybe be a week. And, you know, are you available that week? Are you busy doing something else? So another way to do the same thing is actually do that in the fall. So after growth has stopped, and you're sure that you're not going to get a warm spell and, you know, something's going to germinate, but before the snow hits. You know, some winters, that's a small window too, but some years we don't get snow till December, so we broadcast seed out there. And then what happens is in the springtime, we get that freeze-thaw action that helps get some seed-to-soil contact. Usually a much bigger window, I get a lot more acres done that way. Alternative to that is in front of the cattle, right? Get some high stock density out there and get them to stomp it into the ground. Or in front of a big rainstorm. If I know there's a big rain event coming, I can get some seed out there and that happens. Now, it doesn't always germinate right away. I've seen seeds come up months later and I've seen seeds come up years later. For example, I just had a field that I seeded in 2023 with a bunch of legumes and clovers. They didn't germinate. Nothing came up for, you know, quite a while. And this summer, not even in the springtime, but in the summertime, second rotation, I've got clovers, you know, a foot and a half tall, thick, so thick the dog can't run through it.
Yeah, so a lot of hard seed, maybe.
Yeah. Well, the conditions were right. We finally got the moisture, right? We got a good rain event. I think we actually got, that pasture got 3 inches in middle of June. Whereas the pasture 15 minutes from it didn't get it. So, and that's just, it just needs the right conditions and those seeds are there, right?
Sure.
A lot of people ask me, well, what about just leaving, you know, let nature do what nature does and just let it go. I've done that numerous times as well, but boy, it's night and day difference when I actually put the seeds out there. It speeds it up. I have a video I posted on Facebook years ago. I purposely skipped a gap on a cultivated field I was seeding down. And 5 years later, you can still see that gap plain as day. It's, not near as good a quality.
You mentioned about getting more acres done. So, like, what is it like when you drone seed something? How does that work?
drone seeding. It's it doesn't carry very much seed, and the batteries don't last very long. So I basically am landing that thing every 8 minutes, but the pit stops really quick.
So how many acres do you do in that time, or how much?
I can do, on average, about 15 acres an hour. So, for example, I went did some cover crop seeding a few weeks back. I put in long days. I think they're 12 to 14 hour days, but I did 450 acres in 2 days. So I can get a lot done, right? I can keep moving, and as long as you can keep moving with it and kind of stay close to the machine, you can seed a lot in a day.
Yeah. So you just sit at the farmstead there with the bank of chargers?
I keep it in my truck. So I got a generator on the back of my truck. And then I move along with the drone, it speeds it up. If I have to sit at the far side of the field, like on a grain crop, I've done that, where you got to, you know, maybe I'm putting a cover crop over top of corn or something. Then I'm slower, 10 or 11 acres an hour. You just got too much empty fly time. But if I can stay with the drone and move along with it, we can get a lot done in a day.
How much seed did you say the drone carries?
With legume seed, right, small heavy seeds, I can get probably 17 to 20 pounds in my tank. So if I'm seeding 5 to 8 pounds an acre, it matches the batteries nice, and we can get a lot done that way. If I get a lot of light, fluffy grass seeds in it, or the one legume that's light and fluffy is sainfoin, then it slows me down because I can't get enough seed in my tank, right? If they want 14 pounds an acre and it's fluffy grass seed, my seed tank runs out before my battery does. I'm landing the thing every 2 to 3 minutes, so it slows me down, but still possible.
So how long have you been seeding with a drone, you said?
2 years now, 2.5 years.
Okay. So what kind of got you started with it?
Oh, I had a little drone. And there was a funding program that came out in Canada that was promoting seeding legumes. And I thought, well, if everybody's going to be seeding legumes, maybe that'll help pay for this thing. So I'm definitely a believer that if you own a piece of equipment, it's got to make some money. So I'm the rancher that's been ranching for 25 years. I've never even owned a tractor. So it's unique for me to buy a piece of equipment, but it sure saved me a lot of my land already, and I've got everything seeded, and I will need it again someday, I'm sure. But now I've done some custom work with it too, and yeah, it's pretty handy.
Yeah, you like trying new things, it sounds like. That's kind of, I like that about you.
I had a little drone for videoing, and I really liked it, so then this opportunity came up, and it's a little bit monotonous, but yeah, it's still fun. It's a very unique toy that most people don't get to play with.
Yeah. Maybe you know this, you know, at the pasture walk at Cincinnati tomorrow, they're going to show how they use the virtual fencing. Yeah. And so, you know, that's a lot of people are talking about that now. What is your take on virtual fencing right now?
Virtual fencing. I've been waiting for it for 20 years. I'm pretty sure it's 20 years plus. I was at a conference in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, and they talked about this virtual fencing, and I was all excited about it. It's taken a long time to get here. The problem I see with it, and I don't have it, and I'm a little resistant to get it now after I've been waiting so many years. Are we replacing cheap labor with very expensive labor, in a way? Because some of the guys that have it, I've heard that they got to bring the herd in, put all the collars on, right? That's 2 to 3 people, 4 people. The number of times you got to process the whole herd just for collars. And then if something goes wrong, you got to bring it in. And plus you got a monthly fee. I'm not sure. I'm not sure in the long run it's going to be cheaper than hiring that guy for $20 an hour to go out and move your cross fence.
Sure. Yeah, and I've been learning about it as I work on grazing plans, and I've just been asking a lot of questions, trying to understand. You know, like how do you know how much grass is out there?
Yeah.
And if you don't go and look at it, you're, you know, so. but you know, there is potentially some cost sharing available now for people to use it.
Yeah, I guess my ultimate question is it worth it without a funding program? Right? I mean, a lot of people are buying them right now because of funding programs, but I was at a tour out in British Columbia a year or two ago, and we were looking at a dairy farm, and you guys out here in Wisconsin probably know way more about this than me, but just the comment from one of the other participants, looking at a dairy farm that went to computerized milking, and how wonderful it is, and the, you know, the robot milking, whatever they called it, and one of the other guys in the tour kind of talked to me on the side, and he said, yeah, we did that 10, 15 years ago, and we went away from it. He said, what we found is we're saving on the $15 an hour work, but then we get way more $300 an hour work. When that computer goes down, now you've got a really expensive technician to come in and fix it. And one breakdown or one malfunction, and you just paid for a, you know, 2 weeks worth of your hired hand to go milk cows. So that's where I get that. Well, you know, are we saving the $15 an hour work to pay somebody $300 an hour to go out and check your fence because your collars aren't working? I don't know. It'd be really handy. Boy, I wish I could, you know, strip graze like that, but it's got to be economical too. So.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, when you adopt a new technology, how does that usually work for you? Like, what's the process?
Yeah, we got to run the numbers. Got to run the numbers, see what your total costs are. And again, without subsidy, is it worthwhile? I've got a gross margin analysis that we run, and kind of break it down on a per profit center basis.
Which in your case, the profit center is what?
For custom grazing is my main profit center.
What is?
Custom grazing, right? We also have, we do have a small flock of sheep that we're building. We just kind of bought some sheep here. I was waiting to get a good perimeter fence, and all of a sudden we got a big perimeter fence. So I had no more excuses not to get sheep. So my wife talked me into it pretty easy. So we got sheep. We've got the one profit center is the drone seeding, right? Which really, I don't really have to do that because I've already seeded all my land. It's already paid for itself on my own land. But a lot of people love seeing the drone too. So it's fun just to go out and show people too.
Sure. Well, okay. So you and I probably know what custom grazing, how that work, that business model works, but maybe could you break it down for anybody listening?
Sure. Like I said before, we live close to one of the really big cities in Canada, and the land is very expensive. So I lease land from private owners. So I don't know if you guys, do you guys have community pastures here?
No, we don't. We have public land that sometimes is grazed.
Okay, so we have community pastures, which is public lands, and then they set them up as a, it's called a community pasture. So multiple people can apply to put their cattle there. It's usually a little bit cheaper to go there. You might not, you know, you don't get your choice of bulls necessarily. I think there's some that supply bulls, some that, you know, if you bring animals, you got to bring a certain percentage of bulls with them, but you're not necessarily going to have your bulls breeding your cows, right? So it's a community pasture, but it's usually cheaper. So basically I lease land from private landowners, try and get land together to make it bigger. And then I custom graze other people's cattle. So a little unique model. I don't own the land and I don't own the cattle, but I do all the management. So we've been doing this since, I think 2001 is when I started the custom grazing. And it made a lot of sense to me because I didn't have the market risk. I didn't have the death loss risk. I didn't have, you know, all of a sudden the price of hay goes through the roof. It's very low risk. I get paid monthly. Yeah, it's been really good to me.
So it's, I'm imagining you get paid, is it per day or is there some other?
Yeah, we charge out per head per day, depending on the class of livestock. So cows versus yearlings, pairs versus opens, right? The price varies, but
yeah, and I know there's some other ways of charging, like, you know, per or based on weight of gain.
Per pound of gain, yeah.
Per pound of gain. Have you looked at those or done those things?
No, I stay away from that because there's something else we have in Canada. You guys don't have it, so it's, you know, probably not going to help you much to tell you about it, but I will anyway.
Tell me. I think people want to know, you know, it's about different things.
We have a legislative act in Canada. It actually, originally, it was from the 1800s. It was to protect the animal keeper. So, you know, the stable keeper, that it, actually, up until about 10, 15 years ago, it was still called the Livery and Stable Keepers Act. So they finally updated it about 10 years ago. Now it's called the Animal Keepers Act.
Yeah, what is a livery anyway?
Where the horses stayed, I think, yeah.
Okay, yeah. But you have some horses, right?
We got a donkey and a pony, that's about it. I'm not the true cowboy. I get way more done on a day with a quad or my sidekick.
You know, I have to say, I was disappointed you didn't show up for this paddle in a cowboy hat. It was not as advertised.
Yeah, I don't want my good Stetson out here in case you dump me over.
So they changed it to the Animal Keepers Act.
Yeah, so the Animal Keepers Act, basically, if I don't get paid, I have the legal right to take the animals to auction to get my money back. So the Crown actually gets the Crown would be our government, right? Because we're still under the Commonwealth, sort of. They say the money would go to the Crown, the owner. We would get our fees out of that first, and then the owner can apply to get the remainder. So basically, it's a lien of possession only. I only have that lien if I have the animals under my control. If I let them go home, I lose my lien. And if we get paid by the pound of gain, they have to go somewhere to get weighed, unless I have a scale, right? So, yeah, I don't want them to leave until I've been paid.
Sure. And so then you said you get paid monthly for your daily grazing.
Yeah, we get paid monthly in advance, actually. I think I slow down on the corners because I watch you go through the fast stuff and then I avoid them.
Well, hopefully that's what everyone listening to the podcast is doing. They're listening to you, learning, avoiding the mistakes. Or
that's the best way to learn, is learn from other people's mistakes, right?
Well, I thought it was to make your own, but
I would rather learn from someone else's. But yeah, I've made a lot of my own too.
Yeah, is there any mistakes that you want to talk about?
Oh, mistakes I've made. Let me count them. Probably the biggest mistake is in human resources. Not getting out of a deal when I knew I should have. Was a landowner issue. Caused a lot of issues, and I ended up lost revenue because of it. So, yeah, human resources is the biggest, most important part of my business.
Well, okay, so then, like, how do you vet a landowner or a deal that you're getting into?
How do I vet it?
Yeah.
First thing is I listen. Go in and talk to them, and you got to find out what kind of personality they are. One of the biggest tools I ever, you know, learned how to use, the best advantage I used because of it, is learning about personality styles and, you know, how to communicate with people if they're in a different personality style than you. The way I look at it, there's four different personality styles. I use the DISC test, is the one I learned with, DISC. And basically, there's four different languages. We just speak them all in English. So what I say, somebody with a different personality style might hear something totally different. So I gotta first listen and figure out what personality style they are and what they want and what their goals are, and then try and adapt and communicate in a way that they will respond to me, right?
Can you give me just like a brief example?
So I'm a D personality, which is a very direct, right? I just want to tell me the punchline. Don't worry about the details. I want the answer.
Wait, what is the DISC part? What are the four?
So, yeah, D is for dominance. I is for influencer, which is your social butterfly. They like to communicate. They want to make sure people like them all the time, and they're very social. S, what's that one stand for? They are the hard worker, resistant to change. And the C is the conscientious. They are the perfectionist, right? They got to know all the details. They got to do things in order. They want to make sure things are the way they're supposed to be. So as a D personality, if I go in with my blunt, quick to the point, you know, attitude, I'm going to lose the other personalities. The I is a social butterfly. They just want to chit chat, right? If I'm in and out in 5 minutes and they're like, what happened there?
Like, yeah. Before they get down to business, they want to chat.
Yeah. He blew out of here like a storm. I don't know if I want to work with him. Perfectionist personality, right? I don't care how it gets done. I just want the end result as a D, but they want to know every detail on how it's done to every fence post, to every, you know, make sure those lines are straight. I've actually lost land because of a crooked fence before. So it's
a fence you built, I assume. Yeah.
Yeah. For 10 years, it bugged him that fence was crooked.
So he kicked you off?
Yeah, well, he was grateful. He actually heard him say that he's so glad to get that fence out of there. It's bugged him for 10 years. But I moved the fence with the type of forage, right? If it's a tree line, I will follow the tree line so that I keep the forest separate from the open land, right? But back then, I didn't communicate that with him ahead of time is why that fence was crooked. But it just bothered him because of his personality style. So very important to understand that. Be able to communicate in their language, not necessarily in my language.
Yeah, and then you have your podcast. Can you talk more about the podcast? Explain that for people.
Yeah, sure. Our podcast is called Wednesday Night Networking. We partnered with the Gateway Research Organization. They're a local applied research association in our area.
It sounds like it's a farmer-led thing. Is that right?
Yeah, you bet. It's a board of farmers that kind of direct it. And then they've got a manager hired to run the show. And I think there's 6 or 7 employees right now. But they partnered with me. It actually happened because of COVID. When COVID hit, everything shut down. And all of a sudden, everybody had to do seminars and conferences virtually. So I got hired to do a couple. And here I am on my computer, do my little conference, tell my jokes. No, I don't know if anybody's laughing, right? Like, there's nobody on the screen, right? Maybe the host. And a couple of questions through the host, and then all of a sudden the screen goes blank. And I was like, where's the networking? Where's the sitting down at coffee or around, you know, at break or after in the evening, going out to the lounge and having a couple drinks? Where's the networking? Because I would say 80 to 90% of my education over the last 25 years comes from the networking, right? Talking to that farmer, talking to that presenter after, and asking those questions. And all of a sudden it was gone. So, you know, I thought about it a little bit, and a lot of people were doing webinars and online conferences, and I'm like, the networking's still not there. So I decided to talk to Gateway, and they were eager to jump on board. And we did just networking. So I stay away from presentations. It's not really a webinar. We bring on a guest every 2 weeks. Every week, we did it every week to begin with, but it was busy. Oh my gosh, that's a lot of work. I got enough going on already. So we do it every 2 weeks now in the wintertime, in the off season. And we bring on a guest. We pick a topic. Whatever the guest feels like, you know, I always ask them, what are you most passionate about right now? Because that usually comes into the best conversations. And then we just, you know, her and I usually have a conversation for 10 minutes about what we're doing, what's going on, and introductions. And then we open it up to questions. And it's basically, it's an hour and a half long. And we basically usually have about an hour of Q&A. And people just get to ask the guest questions. And we've had, you know, Joel Salatin, Gabe Brown,
Alan Savory, Greg Judy, right? We've had some pretty big names on there. And people, like, get to ask them questions, right? So it's kind of cool. And then after the hour and a half, we shut off the recording, and we open up the after networking. And then we just leave it on. Because it just bugs me that, you know, on those webinars before and during COVID, that they would just turn it off and the screen went blank. So I don't turn it off. I just let people chit-chat. So the guests usually stay a little bit longer and answer any remaining questions, but we definitely tell them they can go whenever they want. But sometimes we've had people on at like 11 o'clock at night still, just visiting and chit-chatting, and, you know, that networking is so important. So
that's really cool. Are there any other resources you want to share with folks who are listening right now before we wrap up?
Yeah, my main social media is Facebook. I know it's kind of old school, but I was told years ago, if you're going to do something, do one of them good. So I just stuck to one. I think it copies to Instagram now, but I don't really pay attention to that very much. I mostly just post on Facebook. We do some, there's some YouTube videos, but not as many as I'd like, but we're kind of busy. It's kind of hard to get videos done all the time. But there are some videos that we do. And Wednesday Night Networking, it's actually on the Gateway Research Organization's podcast. I think it's under Podbean, but if you look up podcast Wednesday Night Networking, you should be able to find it. So, and yeah, Facebook and YouTube is under Greener Pastures Ranching.
Very cool. Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah, you bet.
Farmers and Friends of the Kickapoo. And it's just another resource for folks. Is the Golden Sands Resource Conservation and Development website. It's at goldensandsrcd.org. And our grazing team has put on there some resources for folks. We've recorded webinars talking about grazing economics. We have resources like a list of where you can rent a no-till drill for seeding pastures. And we're hoping to put up the keynote recording of Steve Kenyon's talk, which we're doing tomorrow at Sinewa Mound. And there's a lot of resources on there. Again, Golden Sands with an S, rcd.org. So thanks, everybody, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you to the following individuals and organizations for their contributions to this episode of the Farmers and Friends of the Kickapoo podcast. Lisa Jamila and Frito Jamila Worth for use of the two kayaks. National Association of Conservation Districts for supporting podcast production through an outreach and technical assistance grant. Pointers Connect Internship Program at the University of Wisconsin-Stevens Point for internship services. This podcast episode was edited and captioned by Angel Rackow, Golden Sands RC&D media production intern. Thanks to our sponsors and partners for the Wisconsin workshops with Steve Kenyon. Greener Pastures Ranching Limited, Grassworks Inc., United States Department of Agriculture, Natural Resources Conservation Service, Fields of Cincinnati, Gallagher Next Fencing, Byron Seeds, LLC, Sand County Foundation, Wisconsin Farmers Union, University of Wisconsin-Platteville, Wisconsin Department of Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection, and the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. Additional support was provided by Sauk County Land, Resources, and Environment Department, Sauk Soil and Water Improvement Group, Valley Stewardship Network, Vernon County Land and Water Conservation Department, Compeer Financial, and Narrows Valley Supply. This document was made possible through a grant from the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation. This material is based upon work supported by the U.S. Department of Agriculture under Agreement 2004.25.085349. The views and conclusions contained in this document are those of the authors and should not be interpreted as representing the opinions or policies of the U.S. government or the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation and its funding sources. Mention of trade names or commercial products does not constitute their endorsement by the U.S. government or the National Fish and Wildlife Foundation or its funding sources. Prepared with assistance from USDA Natural Resources Conservation Service. USDA is an equal opportunity provider and employer.
This podcast was brought to you by Golden Sands RC&D. Copyright 2025. All rights reserved.